from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, global consciousness, ESP. How does it all work? Here's what's happening. America's top military officer has raised the specter of U.S. troops in Iraq taking on a combat role to fight ISIS, a position that was quickly knocked down by the White House. General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that it was possible that U.S. troops advising and assisting Iraq's military could be deployed to fight. Now, the president has repeatedly said, no ground troops. Let's check in with Jerry Corsi from WND.com and noted author. Jerry, there seems to be a little confusion here in Washington.
It was surprising testimony. I think when General Dempsey said that there may be a need to put boots on the ground in Iraq to fight ISIS, it really contradicted the Obama administration policy that we were not going to use ground troops. And there was a lot of backtracking all afternoon with the White House saying, well, these were just hypothetical situations and hypothetical questions. But I think the testimony of General Dempsey and Secretary Hagel today to the Senate made it clear that it's going to be very difficult to win a battle defeating ISIS or setting it back significantly without some involvement of ground troops, even though politically that's something that the White House does not want to say, at least not at this point.
Jerry, I was watching Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams. I had seen it when it first came out, and I wanted to see it again. I just, you know, he's a great talent. God love him, and God rest his soul. But it dawned on me watching the movie that, you know, we pull out and a place crumbles, right? We pull out of Vietnam,
right. Yeah.
Vietnam crumbles. We pull out of Iraq, it starts to crumble. No matter where we go, it crumbles. Haven't we learned our lesson?
Well, I think that's a very good point, George. And by the way, that is a great movie. That was a great, great role Robin Williams played. The problem is that the United States has capabilities in terms of military that no other nation really has. Our military is number one in the world and has been. We should always be proud of the men and women who defend the United States. They do such a wonderful job. And when they pull out, it's very difficult for a nation like Iraq or Vietnam to have the same kind of influence, the same kind of impact as the U.S. military had. And, you know, the forces in Iraq had become very dependent on the U.S. military. The Iraqi military ran and abandoned weapons, which now ISIS is using to fight. So it's a very difficult situation when we leave these countries.
Now, yesterday I had William Forstchen on the show. Of course, he wrote the book One Second After. As you and I know, we're working on a joint campaign with WND to try to get the power grid insulated.
Yes.
And Michael Maloof, of course, is in there too.
Yes.
But one of the things, he's got a new book out now called The Wrath. And it's a novel, but his theory, Jerome, is that ISIS already has people in the United States and that they're prepared to do something heinous, maybe hit schools and do that kind of butchery. Is that conceivable?
Well, unfortunately, George, I think with the open southern border and with all the evidence that's been accumulating that ISIS agents have been in Mexico and are trying to get into the United States and may have succeeded, the potential of having sleeper cells and ready to commit terror acts has to be taken seriously. And it's a two-way street. We have a number of Americans going over and fighting with ISIS, and that establishes kind of a two-way communication. So there has to be pockets of support for ISIS here in the United States. I hope that the Department of Homeland Security will be able to handle any ISIS threat in the United States, but I do worry with a wide open border in Mexico.
Let's keep in touch. Jerry Corsi, WND.com. President Barack Obama has called West Africa's deadly Ebola outbreak a looming threat to global security, and he has announced a major expansion of the U.S. role in trying to halt its spread, including deployment of 3,000 troops in the region. Now, how is that going to stop Ebola? Well, here's the plan. sending the 3,000 troops, including engineers and medical personnel, establishing a regional command and control center in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, commanded by Major General Darrell Williams, who arrived there on Tuesday, and forming a staging area in Senegal to help distribute personnel and aid on the ground. It also calls for building 17 treatment centers with 100 beds each, placing U.S. Public Health Service personnel in new field hospitals in Liberia, training thousands of healthcare workers for 6 months or longer, and creating an air bridge to get health workers and medical supplies into West Africa more quickly. I think we need a cure for Ebola. Depression, by the way, is not just difficult to treat, it also is difficult to diagnose. Scientists are continually looking for better ways to detect this very serious mental illness in patients who may not even want to talk about it. Now a new study suggests that a simple blood test could soon allow doctors to diagnose clinical depression as easily as they check cholesterol. The test looks at levels of 9 RNA blood markers, which appear to be different among patients with diagnosed clinical depression versus those who don't have depression. A woman in Thailand died after committing suicide, jumping into a pond filled with hungry crocodiles. My gosh. Workers at the farm tried to use long sticks to prevent the crocodiles from attacking the 65-year-old woman, but failed. Waistlines are continuing to expand despite obesity appearing to be reaching a plateau. Research suggests the average adult waist size in the U.S. increased more than an inch between 1999 and 2012. And what has become a recurring theme in America's trip back from the 2007 to 2009 recession, most U.S. households again saw no noticeable increase in their income last year. A report from the Census Bureau showed that the country's median household income edged up a whopping $108.80 last year to $51,939, again deemed statistically, who cares? Income at the median level, meaning half the country earned more, half earned less, has declined nearly $5,000 since 2007. Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz. What do you think of that, Catherine?
Well, it's going to make for an interesting midterm election, George. I don't know if you saw the Gallup poll out on the 12th, but 76% of Americans now say they're dissatisfied. And when I worked in Washington, 80% was the magic number. When you hit 80%, you got transformational shifts in what happened. So I think we may be coming into an inflection point. People are really willing to take action. They are
very
dissatisfied.
They are not happy these days, Catherine, not happy campers at all. And in terms of the overall economy, I continue to get advice from advisors that the stock market is going to collapse. Do you think so?
First of all, anything can happen. I think the odds of that happening are relatively small. If anything, I see more and more capital shifting out of fixed income towards the equity markets. But here's the thing. All economies are based on trust, George. And when you see these kind of poll numbers and survey numbers and dissatisfaction, trust is breaking down. So, you know, I think that there's a very deep relationship between people's trust and their consciousness, and they're willing to invest forward in the economy. And that, you know, that's why the economy is so dependent on more government money and Fed injections. You know, the Fed's meeting tomorrow. And, of course, you know, they need to taper starting next month. But what they need is, you know, the natural economy and markets to occur. Markets can't occur where people don't trust each other.
No, they don't. I don't think the Fed will raise interest rates at all in the window, according to some of these people who are prognosticators. Between now and September 25th of next year, look for the bubble to burst.
Well, you know, here's the thing. There are still positive things going on. So, you know, part of what we're seeing, George, is a shift because of technology. It's quite extraordinary. And just remember, if you look at the polls worldwide, countries that have been poor but where incomes are rising are feeling much better about their circumstance. So part of this is the rebalancing of the global economy, and it's not all bad.
And the value of some of these companies, particularly like Facebook, they're talking about $200 billion. My gosh, Catherine.
Think of it. Just think of it. The intelligence agencies have found a way for everybody to update their files on a real-time basis, and they're making money.
I love it. Catherine, be well.
Bye.
Catherine Austin Fitz, her website, Solari.com, part of our Twitter feed. Daredevil Nick Walenda, who last year completed a high-wire walk over the Grand Canyon, has announced plans for an untethered tightrope walk between Chicago skyscrapers on a night in November, on November 2nd. Amazing. He's 35 years old. He's the seventh generation member of the Flying Walendas. He is going to be way up there. Walenda's great-grandfather, Carl Walenda, slipped and fell to his death from a high wire in Puerto Rico back in 1978. And NASA has picked the companies it hopes can take the country's astronauts back into space. It's awarding up to $6.2 billion to Boeing and SpaceX firms to help them finish the development of new crew capsules. Since the space shuttles were retired in 2011, we have relied on Russia and its Soyuz vehicles to help get us to the International Space Station. Boeing and SpaceX should have their seven-person cruise ships ready to take over the role by late 2017. Let's check in with space historian Robert Zimmerman about this story and others next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us this hour, space historian, of course, his incredible website, behindtheblack.com. He writes articles and books on the issues of science, history, technology. And Robert, a $6.2 billion contract to Boeing and SpaceX. SpaceX, of course, created by founder Elon Musk, who created PayPal. Everything this guy touches, including Tesla Motors, seems to turn to gold.
George, actually, just so you know, the whole amount that NASA's proposing to spend here is $6.8 billion. They're going to give $4.2 to Boeing and $2.6 billion to SpaceX. They're going to both be producing their own spaceships to get astronauts to and from ISS. Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, yes, everything they touch has turned to gold. This has been an incredible week for SpaceX. For example, this week, they revealed that they've signed 9 new commercial deals.
Wow.
For commercial satellites. That's a lot of money in their pockets, some of which will be launched on their Falcon Heavy rocket, which they haven't even tested yet. This same week, they also coming on this weekend, if everything goes right, they're going to launch the Dragon capsule to ISS to bring cargo. That will be the fastest turnaround they've done between two launches. It would be less than 2 weeks, which means they're really ramping up to almost a train schedule in terms of launches, commercial launches, that brings in the bucks. On top of that, they've announced that they're going to break ground on their own private spaceport near Brownsville, Texas, at the very southern tip of Texas on the Gulf Coast. And they're going to do that next week. And then today, NASA announced that it has chosen, of the 4 or so companies that have been competing to build ships that could bring crew up and down the ISS, NASA has picked 2 companies, Boeing and SpaceX, to do it, and to do it by 2017. This is an interesting, within the United States, George, this is going to be an interesting space race. Because you've got Boeing, big space, the old company, the companies that have been around for decades, that have done all the old kind of work at very high cost that usually takes forever to do, versus new space, SpaceX, lean.
Why have they split it up basically?
Well,
now Boeing gets the lion's share, but why 2 companies? Why not just 1?
Well, this is NASA's approach to this in the Obama administration, is they want competition and they want redundancy.
Okay.
Remember when the shuttle, when the Challenger accident happened specifically, and then later with the Columbia accident, we suddenly had no redundancy. We only had 1 way to get astronauts up to ISS.
That's right.
So having more than 1 ship that can get us up there, of course, gives us redundancy. It also helps foster a competitive robust industry, and that's another reason to do it. But there's also political reasons why they picked these two companies. Congress, as a general rule, wanted Boeing to get the contract because Boeing is an older company with a lot of employees and a lot of congressional
districts. And a lot of clout.
That's right. A lot of lobbying count, and it's also pork to a lot of congressional districts. So Congress critters wanted the money to go to Boeing. But right now, to not have picked SpaceX would have been absolutely an insane public relations disaster, because not only does Boeing not build anything there, CST-100 capsule, which the design is probably very good because they're a good company in terms of engineering, they haven't built anything. They've just done design reviews. They've put together a mock-up we can look at, but that's not the real craft. SpaceX, meanwhile, has the Dragon capsule that has flown already four times to ISS. It's going to fly again this weekend. They only need to add the launch abort system so that during launch, if there's astronauts on it, it can safely get away from the launch pad. And they're going to do tests of that in December and January. So to not pick the SpaceX this close to success would be insane. So NASA looked at this and said, well, politically, if we pick SpaceX, we're going to get Congress pissed at us. And if we pick Boeing, we're going to get everybody else pissed at us. So let's pick both. And then their problem is that they've got to get Congress willing to commit the money, $6.8 billion, to build both. Well, the politics that I've just described makes it difficult for Congress to say no to both. Because if Congress wants to give the money to Boeing because they want to get that pork, and Boeing might successfully build its capsule. I'm a little more skeptical of them, but they have the technical skill to do it.
Well, just this craft, though, Robert, is it just going to be to get people up and down from the ISS, or are there other applications here?
The Boeing craft, CST-100, they're designing it focused entirely on just up and down to low Earth orbit. Elon Musk's company has always said that they're building spacecraft with the intention of making it possible for Elon Musk to die on Mars. I mean, to die after living a long time, but dying on a colony on Mars. So they want to absolutely expand beyond just simply getting up and down to ISS. And absolutely with these two companies, you can possibly do that. I think that it's going to be politically hard for Congress not to fund both. That's going to happen. And then we get a really exciting situation, George, because once again, we've got competition between big space, old space, and new space with SpaceX. And hey, may the best company win. And in fact, what I think happens, as I always say, competition is the most wonderful thing. It really gets the blood flowing, and it makes everybody very excited. And I think it's going to be very entertaining the next 2 years.
I think so, too. Now, what happens to Richard Branson's company and Burt Rutan's company? Are they going to fall by the wayside?
Well, all right. Virgin Galactic, it's Spaceship Two suborbital tourism business, built by Scaled Composite, Burt Rutan's company. Well, they were maybe in the lead a decade ago to do space tourism, but it's taken them a decade. The world is beginning to pass them by. Richard Branson had said most of this year that he was going to fly his first flight by the end of this year, and he only admitted on David Letterman about 2 weeks ago that no, he's not going to fly till February. So it's getting delayed again. Well, at a certain point, these private companies that can put spacecraft into orbit are going to be a competitor with the suborbital tourism, and they're going to lose, especially considering that Sarah Brightman, singer star of Broadway stage, is going to fly into ISS next year for a short period of time, a week, and sing from orbit, and she's going to be a tourist in orbit. And so once again, the shift of the business is going to go back to orbit, I think. I think suborbital will happen, but I think the world is beginning to pass them by.
It's amazing stuff. Truly
it's incredibly exciting.
Jeez. When I saw the story today, and I know a lot of people who work for Boeing, so they're jumping for joy. But, you know, it's almost like Facebook coming into the new age and digital coming into the new age against the old. It's going to be refreshing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know what's really good about this is that Boeing is old space, and in many ways they have not been very competitive or even tried to be innovative or competitive the last few decades. But this could re-energize that company, and I wish them well, because now they are then they've pushed for this. Well, they've got it now, and you got to be careful what you wish for, because they can't just simply do what they've done in the past, which is kind of like got the development money, made some good blueprints.
They're going to have it all. Hey, hold on, Robert. We're going to come back, talk more, and take calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. We're going to take phone calls with him this half hour as we're talking about the exciting announcement. If you love space, and I grew up in the space age like many of you did, and it just excites me, with NASA awarding $6.8 billion to Boeing and SpaceX to get a new spacecraft going. Now, what do you think the craft will look like, Robert? Will it echo the space shuttle?
Well, okay, the Dragon spacecraft that SpaceX is building, it looks like a capsule. It's already flown several times. People have seen it. It's basically be that space capsule, just with some minor modifications to make it safer. The Boeing spacecraft is called the CST-100, which stands for Commercial Space Transport 100, and it is essentially a capsule just as well. SpaceX wants its spacecraft to eventually be able to land on land using rockets to vertically land anywhere. Not on a runway, but vertically land using rockets. Boeing's craft will come down on parachutes with airbags and would be able to land on the ocean or on land. So in a sense, they're both throwbacks to the 60s, and in that sense, it's a disappointment from my perspective. But I think that by having multiple companies able to do this at low cost, what you do is you reducing the cost to get into space encourages more people to go and more customers to be able to buy the services. And that, of course, will encourage more innovation and development, which will bring us back to something like the shuttle eventually.
All right. To the phones we go. Let's go to Bill, the amateur astronomer on the wild card line. Gosh, Bill, you call so much, I know who you are.
Yes. Hi, George. Hi, Bill. Hi, Robert Zubern. I am an amateur astronomer, and I know space and astronomy to a T.
And you're an atheist.
I'm an atheist, too, because of my background in science. I go by data, logic and reason, the scientific method. But let me get to my questions about the space program. Two questions, A and B. A, I want to talk about, I'm going to ask you a question about the follow-up to Curiosity, the Mars 2020 rover. Why, question number one, why can't that rover actually look for present life on Mars, not past microbial life on Mars, evidence of that was what they're looking for, but actually drill down deep and look for life on Mars when it gets there in 2020, 2021. And question number two, also on life in space, specifically the moon Europa, the moon of Jupiter called Europa, what can we, the American people, get to get the Congress and President Obama, or a future president, who I hope is Hillary Clinton, to get the Europa Clipper mission to fly to orbit Jupiter, which will fly through the vapor plumes, water plumes of the moon Europa, and it can sample organic material, even life, by just flying by Europa. You know Europa Clipper. You know that mission.
Yes. Bill, you've called me before when I've been on the show. It's Bob Zimmerman, not Bob Zubern, who is another great space historian of some note.
Yes, he is.
First, on the 2020 rover that NASA is building, and that connects actually with the Europa Clipper mission, the NASA planetary program existed before the Obama administration has been badly crippled in the last 6-7 years by major cuts. Part of the reason for those cuts is demands by Congress that NASA do certain things, which meant the money wasn't there for planetary missions. The Obama administration's solution to try to keep some planetary mission alive was to actually, in a sense, I think was wise, do something simple that we know how to do already. It might not be simple, actually, but we know how to do it. Rather than redesign a new craft, let's just duplicate the Curiosity rover, do it again, and send it up in 2020. It works. And it's very sophisticated science laboratory, and we know how to build it. And if we don't be overly creative redesign the wheel, we can do it relatively cheaply. And so that's where that rover exists. Now, to look for life in particular, one of the things we learned with the Viking missions to Mars back in the 70s is that if you narrow the research focus too much on these spacecraft, you don't learn quite as much. And so the Viking craft were designed almost expressly to look for life on Mars. And of course, they weren't sophisticated enough, and we didn't really know enough about the planet yet to really know what to look for. And so they came up with very inconclusive results, and that doesn't mean there isn't life or is life on Mars. It means they really didn't learn that much. And they didn't tell us that much about the planets themselves because they were focused so much on that one subject. And what NASA has learned, and the scientists that propose these planetary missions, is that you have to do an overall geological, biological, and biological meaning looking for chemicals, chemical analysis and study of the planet itself. Learn as much as you can about the planet, and then you'll have a much better idea of where to look for life. And right now, we're not quite there to do that. I would say that they haven't, you know, with the 2020 rover, they haven't even gotten to a point where picking candidate landing sites. But we now know a lot more about Mars where we could pick candidate landing sites that would have a much greater chance of having evidence for life. So we're getting closer. But I think we shouldn't narrow the scientific focus that much. Now, in terms of Europa, this gets into a difficult problem we've got. I mean, there isn't a bottomless pit of money. You want to do space exploration for humans to go? Or do you want to do planetary missions where only robots do it? I would like to do both, and I think you should, and you have to think in terms of some intelligent balance between the two. And I think right now we're hitting a good balance. I think that some planetary missions like the Europa mission are going to happen inevitably, but I think one step at a time.
Bob, are you surprised that NASA opened up its purse book?
I think the politics here kind of forced this on everybody, because I think, as I mentioned, Congress wanted to give the money to Boeing, didn't really care whether or not anything got built. That has been the history for the last 30 years. Since the shuttle was built, there have been more than a half dozen attempts by NASA to come up with a next-generation craft to replace the shuttle. None of those got built. Every one of them got financed in the design stage, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars by Congress. But Congress didn't want to really spend the additional money to finish it. And so Congress wanted Boeing to get the job and didn't care if we actually got anything built. But we have this company here, SpaceX, that's really building it and is going to go ahead anyway because they're making a lot of money on commercial program, right, on their commercial launches, and they have the resources to continue. And so they're going to build it anyway. And so now NASA's kind of in a position, and the government, where if you pick just Boeing, you're going to look silly because Boeing won't get it done on time. And if you pick just SpaceX, you make the politicians unhappy. And so they pick both, and it's going to force Congress to finance both. So this is actually very shrewd politics by NASA itself to bring money into the agency and into the space program. And in the end, we get much more bang for the buck because we won't be spending quite as much money. Another way to put it, George, is that it's about $6.8 billion from start to finish to get two spacecraft able to fly. They are spending about $3 billion a year for the Space Launch System and the Orion capsule, and those programs will maybe fly something in about 8 years.
Well, are they going to pick the best of the two, Bob, or are they going to go with both of them?
They're going the way they said it. They're going with both. Both program, both companies have earned a contract. It's got to be financed by Congress, but assume it has been. And that contract is to provide the construction of this spacecraft to get it certified for use. And both companies can go forward to get it certified. Once it's certified, then they then proceed to do anywhere up to, the numbers are still somewhat vague, up to four to more actual missions supplying crew and cargo to ISS.
Okay, next up we go to Rick in Indiana, east of the Rockies. Rick, thanks for calling. You're on with Bob Zimmerman.
Yeah, from 91 until 97, I was bringing my drawings for a hypersonic space plane to NASA facilities, and I think the one thing that scared people off was that it uses my injection reactor to produce the charged particles needed for the fuel engine. But it could be a plane that could actually fly from the ground out into space without switching engines. And then if you really wanted to have something that was sort of simplistic, I was also thinking of the ground ship launch propulsion system, which is basically an electromagnetic type of system for feeding energy into a powered projectile to get you to Mars and beyond. But I think the one thing that people were fearing was that my injection reactor might explode, but I don't believe so. I designed it so that it could actually produce more energy than a regular reactor and actually weigh a lot less. I was wondering if NASA would be interested in anything like that.
I think the place to go with good engineering ideas, and I'm not the engineer, so I wouldn't be the one to go to, nor do I have a space company. I'm just simply a historian and a writer about, and I describe what people are doing. The place to go with these ideas isn't NASA. The place to go is the private companies that are now appearing on the horizon and even right in front of our eyes and propose new ideas to them. If you've got something good that they can do, that will save them money and make it possible for them to get more cargo up into more payload up into space for less cost, they're going to pay attention to you. I mean, there's a company in England right now, Skylon, that's trying to develop a hypersonic jet engine for the purposes of bringing payloads into orbit. NASA and the Air Force, Air Force in particular, is doing test flights of hypersonic material, so you could bring it to them, but that's military. But I would say you bring it to the private companies and you push it. If someone can come up with if you've got a good idea and they see a way to make it work, then you'll be able to sell it. You know, necessity is the mother of invention in these things.
And how soon do you think this will get going? I mean, they were talking about 2017.
Yeah.
That's 3 years from now. Is that a pretty good goal?
Well, it's even a little, it's 2.5 years. SpaceX is very close. SpaceX, I think, is going to win this race without any trouble at all, and I'm challenging Boeing to prove me wrong. I wouldn't be unhappy about that. But SpaceX has the capsule already. It's already flown multiple times to ISS. It's going to do it again this weekend, fingers crossed, nothing goes wrong. All they need to do to make SpaceX acceptable to NASA is add what you call a launch abort system, which is just simply a system to take the capsule away safely away from a launch pad or from a rocket during the launch process, so that if something goes wrong during launch, the astronauts can be, the capsule can be pulled away from the rocket and descend to Earth safely. They had this on Apollo, they had this on the Saturn V. They've had, every rocket system had it except for the shuttle. And so NASA wants to have this, and SpaceX wants to have it, because if you're going to build something like this to sell to customers, you should be providing those kind of things. Well, SpaceX is going to do, in December, its first launch abort test of the Dragon capsule, and they're going to do that on the launch pad. That's going to be quite interesting to watch. They're going to see if, sitting on top of a Falcon 9 rocket, the abort system can lift the capsule off the rocket and bring it down by parachute. And then there, a month or two after, they're going to do a second launch abort test in which they actually launch the rocket, and while it's powered, flying up, they will do a separation and an abort test. NASA has required that to finalize certification for them to be a crew ferry, they also have to do a mission to ISS, a demo mission to ISS. Well, SpaceX is going to be very close to being able to do that, because they already do it now. All they have to do is put an astronaut on the ship. The Dragon capsule was built to be a pressurized, habitable spacecraft from the beginning. So they're pretty close. But 2017 is the date, and I think that's easily going to happen for SpaceX. Boeing, it's a bigger challenge. They haven't built as much, so they've got to get moving if they want to make that date.
Let's go to Port Angeles, Washington. Tom's with us. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very well.
Two questions, if I might. Elon Musk and his granularized rubber propellant was having troubles, and they were talking about switching to Teflon as a fuel for it.
You're thinking actually.
Have you heard of that?
That's actually not Musk. That's You're thinking of Virgin Galactic and its Spaceship Two.
Branson.
They were using a hybrid engine for Spaceship Two, which used rubber as one of its fuels. They have switched now to a different engine that is not a hybrid engine. And I can't give you specifics on the new engine they've switched to, but they're not doing the rubber anymore because they found it didn't have a smooth enough acceleration. The vibrations were too strong. When you fired it for too long a period of time, you could shake the spacecraft apart.
That's good news. That's good news, as long as they're not going to shift to Teflon.
Okay.
So
they could be going. I've heard things about a nylon material, but I don't think, and I could be wrong here, but I don't think that is Spaceship Two's engine right now. So what's your second question, Tom?
Anyway, Teflon's bad. If it is Teflon, Teflon's bad because that's how we make nerve agents, and I don't see that being viable.
Okay.
But the second question is, what do we have? Most of this is we're doing most of this to get people up to the ISS,
yes,
and get the stuff off of it that needs to come off and resupply it. I'm wondering how much is there left to learn, with as long as that's been up there and as big as it's gotten. What is there left to learn when we already know that there are lava tubes coming off the big volcano Mons on Mars on the north coast and or on the north side of it, and there's tundra-like areas that we see the freezing and the thawing in the contours of the surface in those regions. Those lava tubes would be the place to go. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Well, that's a good question, and we're running out of time here. But here, Robert, I mean,
I can answer that.
The ISS, why even go up there?
Well, okay. Well, you know, what Tom's talking about is being on Mars, building a base on Mars, and living on Mars. You got to get to Mars. And I'm sorry, no one in the world right now knows how to build an interplanetary spaceship that can keep people functionally alive for periods of years without resupply,
right,
and without maintenance.
And without going batty, too.
The people can handle that. I mean, you know.
I don't know.
I've never bought that. That's a silly argument. I mean, we had people on whaling ships for years and didn't go batty. Humans are resilient in that respect.
Sure, they weren't batty. They saw mermaids.
We don't know the technical requirements of building a ship that can keep people alive for that kind of time in space, to protect them from radiation, to deal with the medical problems that weightlessness causes, radiation problems that actually affecting vision on ISS. We need to use ISS to learn. Space stations are not space stations. We need to use those kind of vessels in orbit to learn how to build interplanetary ships. The Russians understood this with Mir. I've been beating this dead horse almost. The Chinese know it with their stations now. They're designing them with this in mind as interplanetary spaceships. Prototypes of that, and that's what ISS should be used for. There's going to be a year-long mission next year, finally, on ISS, where you can begin to test some of these things. Now, going to Mars, we have now some good ideas of where to go. There's even a better place than the north slopes of Olympus Mons. There's Olympus Arrhenius. On its western slopes, they have evidence of glacial activity there and of caves in that area, and that would be an ideal place to go. But we have to get there, and to get there is not trivial, and I think it's a mistake to think it's trivial, because then you get very lazy. This is hard work.
Well, if you're into space, if you're into science, what happened today was an amazing story. I shall be back in a moment as we talk about global consciousness with Stephen Schwartz on Coast to Coast.